Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. I'm your host, Anna Fishzahn, and today it's my great pleasure to be speaking with Lawrence Rickles about his brand new book, The Psycho Records, Wallflower Press, which I think is an imprint of Columbia University Press. You can go to their website, from 2016. So, Larry, welcome to the podcast.
I'm glad to be here.
It's great to have you on. I'd like first to briefly introduce you. Lawrence Rickles is a legendary film, media, and literary theorist. He's professor in art and theory at the Academy of Fine Arts, Karlsruhe. He is the author of many other books, Aberrations of Mourning from 1988, The Vampire Lectures, 1999, The Case of California, 2001, Nazi Psychoanalysis, 2002, The Devil Notebooks, 2008. Ulrika Oettinger, The Autobiography of Art Cinema, from 2008. I Think I Am, Philip K. Dick, 2010. And Germany, A Science Fiction, 2015. So just to say even more about your, maybe some more biographical information, after completing his PhD in German Literature and German Studies at Princeton in 1980, I said the year I wasn't going to, but Larry decided to pursue a master's degree in clinical psychology at Antioch University, Santa Barbara, completing that in 1994. Then he completed his residency in psychotherapy, also in Santa Barbara, from 1990 until 2011. You taught at the University of California, Santa Barbara, where you were a professor of comparative literature and German, and also taught in the art department and film and media studies. Finally, as is evident, I think, from even a cursory reading of Larry's work, he's very influenced by Freud, Winnicott, and Klein, and weaves masterful kind of readings of these authors and their insights into analyses of slasher, splatter, and other horror films throughout the book we'll be discussing today. So, Larry, maybe you can begin by telling us a bit about the prehistory of the book, so to speak. How did you develop an interest in, on the one hand, horror films, and on the other hand, psychoanalysis? And did these interests emerge simultaneously?
My interest in psychoanalysis is older than some of these pop cultural pursuits that I picked up when I moved to California and started teaching there. At some point in adolescence, I was curious about problems of mourning. And at least back then, I soon discovered that really only Freud spoke about this problem in any depth. So I became kind of a Freudian and then caught up with that. That passing investment over the years. So when I moved to California, I had to figure out a way to combine my interest in psychoanalysis with the interests that the students brought to class. I'm not such a strategist that I, you know, came up with the best combination right away. I was really just trying to survive. But then I inherited this class. Film studies in those days was a kind of colony of literary departments. And so I had pretty easy access to teaching there. And one day I inherited the horror class, the horror film class. And I had noted for some time, as I was trying to check out my environment, that slasher films were very big. I think Friday the 13th 2 was playing at the local theater. And I was intrigued, and I looked at it, and that was when I decided that I would make the horror film class be about the slasher films that were current back then in the 80s.
Were the students surprised to get Freud in the bargain?
Oh, yeah. And it took a long time for that. I mean, you know, in dog years, it took a long time for that to go down. It really wasn't until I found a connection to occult horror with the vampire, which was then a separate class, that I finally conquered the student body. Mm-hmm. And there's something more upbeat and compelling, I guess, about talking about vampirism in terms of mourning, along the lines of Freud's discussion of ghosts and Totem and Taboo, than, you know, running up against the psychopathic violence in slasher and splatter movies. There's only, at that point, there was seemed to be only so much I could say about it. But then the English School of Psychoanalysis, which actually comes somewhat later in my development. I've really been closely reading Winnicott and Klein for under 10 years. It's the English School of Psychoanalysis that brought me to a point of breakthrough in the legibility of psycho-horror, and that's what encouraged me to go back to this book that's at least as old as the vampire lectures in terms of its being based on transcripts of tape recordings of my lectures in the undergraduate class. So I went back finally just a few years ago to this this old project and was able to update it finally and put it to rest, I hope.
So Psycho Records is this project. It's your lectures, essentially.
Yeah. That's how it began. I mean, it's changed considerably. As I mentioned, also through the intervention of the English school.
Yeah, there's quite a bit of Winnicott.
And then, I owe a lot to him. And, you know, I think I also mentioned in the book that for a long time I thought whatever I had to say, I had kind of ironically already included in the sidelines of the Case of California. So I didn't really feel that I needed even to return to it. But then later on, I had approached the topic of psychopathy in Germany as science fiction. And used Winnicott and Klein then, but especially Winnicott, to in terms of a certain science fiction plotting in American science fiction that keeps on returning to the issue of psychopathic violence. In other words, the opposite of empathy in post-war worlds. And I started reading that as the itinerary of Germany after World War II.
Yeah, I'm sorry. We're having a little bit of audio.
Hold
on. Hello?
Okay.
All right.
Yes?
Go ahead. Keep going. You were in and out just for a second, but please keep going.
Okay. I was just saying that what made the Psycho Records finally really possible was the work I did in Germany as science fiction, talking about the more historical problem of the integration of Germany after World War II, which I did through tracking figurations of empathy and psychopathy in post-war worlds in the projected future in American science fiction.
Yes, one of the things. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, go on. I'm sorry.
No, I just remembered your. I love what you said about. It's really it really comes out of Winnicott and his writings about adolescence and delinquency after the Second World War, where you say that, you know, some of this literature really makes one realize that we all have a brush with psychopathy as teenagers, and so we can it creates this kind of viewing experience of psychopaths because there are potential doubles. It's like the life not led, or some, as you put it,
right, absolutely.
There, but for the grace of the good object, go I, you know. Yeah, that's that was very, I hadn't thought about it that way before. Let's put it this way.
Yeah. So I developed Winnicott's insistence that adolescence is that which we grow out of, into the notion that adolescence also serves as a kind of inoculation over and against psychopathic violence.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, let's talk about a little bit, since you brought up World War II and how this changed horror, you know, Hitchcock's Psycho for a minute. Let's focus on that, because what you call the psycho effect. So here we have like the theme of, you know, mother-son merger with Norman Bates, of course, kind of straddling psychosis and psychopathy, or maybe I misunderstood that, but I thought.
No, that's absolutely correct, because the word psycho is so enigmatic. I mean, is the psycho a psychotic, or does it address the psychopathic violence that's obviously rampant in the genre? And I argue that psychopathy remains the big unknown. I would also probably, with the exception of Winnicott, it's really the failure of interpretation in psychoanalysis, the limit of psychoanalytic hermeneutics. And in mass culture, or popular culture, we see that psychosis, which may not be all that treatable, but is certainly legible after Freud's Schreber case study, the audience popularly also had the sense of psychosis, that through the admixture of psychosis into the enigmatic problem of psychopathic violence, a kind of hold was granted the audience. One was able to understand the mother problem, for example, or the melancholic retention span, which allowed the audience to get past the sort of Ed Gein violence that was otherwise pressing forward in this new genre.
So you would even say it enabled an empathy toward Norman?
Yes, something like that, I would.
Yeah,
curious, I mean, new kind of empathy. You
know? Well, it is interesting. There is a fascination with psychopaths, serial killers now. It seems that with Dexter and all of these kinds of... Dexter, is that over, though, right? I'm very behind in my...
Yeah, no, I don't know either. But it was at the same time as True Blood, which is interesting.
Yeah, well okay, I do want to get to that, but just to stick to Psycho for just a little while longer. So there's the... Also, you discussed the shower scene, of course, which becomes a sort of defining moment and point of reference, actually, for future horror films. And maybe even sort of previous ones, Après Coup, you know. It's like,
right. That's what that's how this project developed. There was a point when I decided that the force of the psycho effect, by which I mean the impact of the shower scene, was such that it also claimed by its recoil earlier horror films as rehearsals of the effect. So, yes, what I call the psycho effect, this is not really another reading of Hitchcock's Psycho. I mean, there is a reading in the book, but it's not the foundation. It's rather how a single scene could prove traumatic and influential, and yet also pose the prospect of a working through in the course of several decades. Because it did arguably vanish. or was displaced so considerably that it's hard to see the continuity. And in the last chapter, I argued that psychopath violence hits the screen again, but no longer under secular conditions, but via multiple references to the devil and the infernal aegis of evil, which is a different treatment.
Do you connect any of this these thematics to a kind of post World War II trauma or attempts to mourn? Because you, I mean, yeah, I mean, is there a particular are there particular affects or narratives that these the shower scene enables? Because you do talk about how in horror, the horror in horror was used to be prior to the war, natural disasters, or that was more common, and then it became, the horror became more about like psychopathy or psychosis.
Right. Now, there's a direct connection to World War II, something I don't go into in the book, but I can just mention it in passing. It's hard to know a whole lot about Hitchcock's work on the concentration camp documentary after World War II. I think Wilder inherited it, if it was the same movie, in fact. But he, in fact, did spend some time editing the material and contributing to that documentary. So there's that connection. But there's also the connection within his own oeuvre between a film like Rope, which as a strange reversal of what he achieved in the shower scene, the absolute absence of editing cuts in the long one or two takes of that film, which is then reversed but also preserved in the tour de force editing of the shower scene. But I also, what I do underscore in the book is that Hitchcock came from an apprenticeship to German cinema before the war, where the themes of doubling and horror and even serial killing were already prevalent, such that Siegfried Krakauer, you know, writes in his book about these German expressionist films in some sense being connected in advance via a kind of teletype with the political events that followed in Germany. So he was trained there in this school of cinema, and knew German, at least enough that he could speak to his wife in German when the daughter wasn't supposed to understand. And he must have known that the shower scene, which he sometimes whimsically refers to as the bathtub scene, that the shower scene does reverberate with the German word and tradition of Schauer, which of course is horror, Gothic horror, for example. So yes, he built all of that prehistory and momentum, I think, into that scene, a scene that was inspired by the book that was the fictionalization of the Ed Gein atrocities in the Midwest.
Can you just say two words about Ed Gein? Because I don't know if our audience, if everybody knows the reference.
Right, right. He's one of the, he's obviously not the first, but one of the, certainly the most, the first really famous case of psychopathic violence to hit the headlines after World War II. And getting back actually to the film that Hitchcock contributed to, but which was completed by other directors. But in that film, I don't know if you ever saw that early documentary, that there's a certain emphasis on Ilse Koch, who was one of the commandants to whom the making of human lampshades was attributed. But anyway, Ed Gein was a close reader of sensational accounts of her atrocities, and was applying that information down to details in his macabre work with corpses. He, in fact, became a murderer later in his spree, but what he essentially did after his mother's death was to redecorate his home with corpse parts that he dug up in the cemetery.
Right.
And that gives us that taxidermy theme that keeps on recurring in the genre.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's...
Like in Silence of the Lambs, I mean, you know.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that there's a, at least in the immediate year, in the years, you know, post-World War II, that these, that you know, treating these themes was a way of trying to understand or get some insight or just maybe even work through some of the Nazi violence or just the fact that people kind of participated or at least let it happen, you know?
I don't think, I think there's a closer link between the science fiction themes I pursued in the book that appeared earlier,
mm-hmm.
and the political and historical details of World War II and post-World War II. But I do think that it brings into focus, as you mentioned, the proximity to psychopathic violence, that the psycho is our potential double, and that it's a violence we have to deal with at various levels. And some of those levels, however, you know, individual moviegoer would probably be hard pressed to link those levels or themes back to World War II. It doesn't stop us from doing that, but I'd say some of the themes, for example, would be how does the survivor relate to the murderer, for example?
Mm-hmm.
The issue of survival is pressing because Marion precisely doesn't survive. And so the genre, the subgenre, just for the sake of innovation, had to begin nominating survivors. But what is the relationship of the survivor to the violence? Like in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the verdict is one remains chained to what one saw. Only in Halloween, I argue, that you begin to see survival separated out from an equation with killing the killer, so that survival in its own right is something that can be affirmed, and not simply within a grim dialectic with the crime itself. So I'm just saying that different aspects of living on after the traumatic work, but in split off ways, as isolated themes, that we sort of try to integrate, but an obvious reflection.
Before we talk more about the content of the book, I actually want to ask you a question about the writing, because it's interesting that these were lectures, so I guess that adds another dimension here, but I found your style quite remarkable, actually, and it's very dense, and just for our audience out there, and poetic. And there's a lot of wordplay and punning and, you know, metaphor. And I mean, every sentence feels like a paragraph. It's so rich. So I'm just curious if you've always written that this way, or does it come easily to you? Is this something that you work on or just sort of happens?
Wordplay, that's the... my literary bent, I guess, but the kind of condensed version that you're referring to comes out of my book, The Case of California.
Mm.
And there, for the first time, I really set myself the experiment of bringing together or juxtaposing sort of Germanic theorizing, like Adorno's philosophy, and the teen idiom of California. So I think the Psycho Records is still within that tradition. I mean, that's what it owes to being on location. It tries to bring adolescent group psychologies into the fold of psychoanalytic theorization.
Mm. So you're playing with their language too, or something. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I'm trying to.
Uh-huh. I'm just so unfamiliar with their language, apparently, that I didn't notice.
Well, some of the language is even part of horror films. Both occult and secular horror. There's the tradition of the so-called groaner. Have you heard about that?
No.
In other words, some of my puns are really, really bad, like the ones about dad and dead. That would be considered a groaner.
Okay, I think.
But I don't mind risking the occasional groaner. Plus, that's recognizable too. Not that my audience is comprised of adolescence, but probably they all did spend time in adolescence.
Yes, because, yeah. Okay, I see some. Now it's becoming clearer. So, okay. Another question. You discuss a lot of these, like, slasher, splatter. I think I'm getting the picture about what the difference is between slasher and splatter. I guess splatter is just more, it's just gorier. Is gory or a word? It's more gory, right?
Yeah. No, it is. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's enough. Okay. I mean, it's the one that begins to border on cannibalism, for example. So it opens up the whole feast of violence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you discuss these films from the 70s and 80s, and there are certain themes that really emerge or that you highlight. So I'm going to kind of bring some of these themes out, and maybe you can talk about them and why they're important or the function that they serve, both, diegetically, and maybe, I don't know, just maybe link it to something sociocultural out there. So masks are a big theme. I think you've tied masks to, shame and guilt. Substitution is another one. Survival, you've mentioned, but also the couple and the community, or the couple versus the, as separating from the community, mourning, inability to mourn trauma, and also a big one is separation and the cut, or, you know, one can say from parental control, but not necessarily, just the kind of maybe individuation as well. So it's very much part of this teen splatter genre, it seems, which I think sometimes really quite explicitly is a negotiation of this separation, or at least this is like a sub theme in a lot of these films.
Depending where one enters the genre or subgenre, so like around Halloween and Friday the 13th.
I'm thinking of my childhood. Yeah, yeah. Okay, you're right. Right. Then that's what I know. Right, those Halloween.
But there you have to imagine the kids in the movie theater because they went there like going to a kind of group therapy session. I mean, they were doing together in the theater what later perhaps smaller group wrapped around the TV or VCR began to do at home or could do at home, which is something that Scream picks up on. Much of that film is organized around the in-group viewing of Halloween that's playing on the VCR. So what's being negotiated there is the tension between the group and the couple. Because in those films, especially Friday the 13th, what is discussed in the group therapy is what are the triggers for the violence. So a certain kind of activity is not allowed, which doesn't mean that one learns taboos in watching Friday the 13th, but one identifies the hot spots of the interaction with the parental couple. As I tried to argue, the group is caught between two couples, the parental couple that's considered out of it anyway, not just off limits, but out of it. And then the future couple that they will more or less inevitably form against the group bond. Inevitably, if only because the group has no reproducing plans of its own. So until technology helps out, usually some kind of pairing occurs to continue with the story. But the group that one imagines watching Friday the 13th is that group between the two couples, reading between the lines of those two couple imperatives. So, and it's different, and I think with Psycho, there, of course, the separation individuation is tracked back more classically to the separation or non-separation from the mother.
Right. Yeah.
An earlier engagement or disengagement. So maybe what you see in the course of this subgenre is that the audience gradually gets a little older and a little older until in Scream they're really 20 to maybe even early 30-year-olds remembering their adolescence. So we reach that point that Winnicott talks about, that what's so great about adolescence for all its turbulence is that, you know, it ends.
It's finitude is what's best about it. Okay. Gotcha. So what about what do we make of this mourning or inability to mourn? Because one of the things that I maybe I'm wrong about this, but it feels to me that zombie films, for example, and the theme of the undead, I mean, I guess we have that earlier, but this zombie in the form of the zombie, the undead in the form of the zombie is becomes popular again, or if it ever, or just becomes popular for the first time, perhaps in the 90s or 2000s. It feels like this, it really bloomed, this subgenre in the, right. Or am I off a little bit on my decade? They're all the same. They're all blurred together. Was it the early 2000s? Was it the?
It was more of a sporadic thing. Mm. I mean, with Romero, for example. But then at one point, it absolutely dominated the cinema, largely because it was looping through those video games that benefited from what is fundamental to zombie entertainment, namely that you have a kind of thrill a kill relationship to destroying the dead. So within the context of that game, I think the thrill factor was always very strong. What's surprising is that rather late in film history, zombieism dominated the screen so completely. And I argue something that's obvious, that it has something to do with 9/11, which was interrupted then by Obama's election, which is when, I argue, vampirism returns. It becomes possible to identify with the undead, to have a more complicated relationship to mourning. Not just this, you know, hunting of zombies, the hunting of the once dead and making them twice dead once and for all.
Mm-hmm. Is that when True Blood, that was the first season of True Blood?
Yeah. All True Blood and...
Buffy?
Oh.
No, that was
earlier. No, that's earlier.
Yes, yeah,
but Twilight.
Oh, Twilight.
They're all pretty much from that same period that led to an alternation then between zombie pictures and vampire fictions. But not just an alternation, it was kind of a shake-up of the horror genre in general, which is probably how Dexter happened. It also re-released the questions of psycho-violence that TV show then addressed.
You know, you talk about, you link, well, you talk about race throughout here and there, but can you say something about the way that True Blood dealt with race? I mean, I've heard, I have some friends who are, you know, film theorists, film scholars, and they talk about how, you know, True Blood was so queer. I mean, maybe you can say something about that too, but they actually speak less about race. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. To the degree that these vampires are like kind of microcosm, social microcosm, or microcosm of the nation, rather. Maybe.
It's certainly the utopian and even literal-minded projection of integration.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at True Blood, once the vampires are introduced as real, as possible neighbors, all kinds of fictional figures want to be included, and not just the usual occult sidekicks like werewolves, but also maenads, all sorts of fantasy figures, shapeshifters, anyway, from different genres is my point.
Mm-hmm.
So that what was so, again, turbulent about True Blood was the absolute blending and inclusion of not just social stereotypes, but even the figures of even the fictional figures hailing from genre that were considered almost opposed in the past. I mean, you never mixed up vampirism and fantasy really before. That's what's striking there. I think the reason people remember the gay theme as subsuming other themes is that one of the lead African-American characters was also gay and ran some kind of club where all sorts of minority vampire interests crossed over, met and crossed over.
Mm-hmm.
But True Blood does continue what would otherwise be identifiable as a political integration, which began really with the Blade films. I mean, to my mind, that's really the first vampire franchise that put an African-American body in the foreground. That was also one of the first vampire films to look at vampires as fully sexual, genitally centered bodies. Whereas before, vampires were relegated to a kind of perversion and at best could be redeemed by psychoanalytic readers who insisted that all of that was a displacement away from genital sexuality that was being somehow disguised. But everything changes then when in True Blood, for instance, the vampires start having regular genital sex, and the biting is some kind of foreplay and not really, a vital investment. And one thing that happens is that all those themes that were included in the condensation of the vampire image are now separate issues, like the issues in society, perhaps, to be addressed and redressed. Perversion is no longer something innate in vampiric sexuality, in other words, in sexuality, mm-hmm. but is now a separate group somehow. That can be accepted and in that sense both integrated and kept at a certain distance. So always when the norm becomes more inclusive and extends further, one has to be a little wary of what edge or margin is being lost. I think what was in danger of being lost, I don't want to say that it was lost, is a kind of intrapsychic corner on the margin, on marginal experience, and ultimately on ambivalence that vampirism had represented and carried forward until some turning point when it was decided that they would be integrated as sexual bodies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that, you know, it also makes me think politically about queer politics and the shift towards gay marriage and queer adoption and, you know, this kind of attempt to integrate, you know, certain kinds of queers, maybe white or at least, you know, people willing to have, quote, families, you know, this kind of within this idea of citizen representative citizenship or the family. So in a way,
absolutely.
I True Blood is
and that's
kind
explicitly
of
thematized. Mm. Yeah, it's not only thematic, it's explicitly thematized in the first year. I only watched the,
oh, okay,
the first year because that
is.
Was our forum assignment.
Okay, a confession, I have never watched it. So I'm so
okay,
obvious.
Okay, there you go.
I think I have some kind of bad. Insight, but it's actually the most, it's like front and center of, anyway. All right. Well,
but in the first year, that becomes a theme. There are certain vampires that live outside of society, and they are gay vampires, I think. Mm-hmm. And they won't be integrated, and they are kind of condemned to ostracism and double death by all parties. Uh-huh. So, I mean, yeah, to be integrated, sexually, genitally centered, regular sex.
Right.
no perversion. It's okay to know perverts that are couplified next door. And so on and so forth. It just creates a whole new map for including vampirism. Or whatever we can call it now.
Okay. So let's move on from vampires to serial killers and their vicissitudes. Because, I was really struck by what you said, actually not so much about, well, I was thinking about serial killers or these psychopathic killers and motives and, you know, what, if you could chart a little bit, you know, how they changed, if they changed, but also related to that, it was your discussion of, you know, like these crime shows that have appeared, like CSI, Las Vegas, or whatnot, and comparing them to Columbo, for example, you know, which is, he's so quaint. But Columbo, you point out, was this, you know, he was part psychoanalyst. He'd actually talk,
oh, yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
And talk to people and figured, you know, interpreted and analyzed. And these CSI guys are just, I don't know what they are. They're like forensics experts who they just have this belief in science and everything is about anatomy and dissection. And but not.
Right.
But anyway, nothing here is like about affect or psyche, or maybe there is something,
well,
and I'm just.
Well, what gets displaced? I mean, what shall I say? The unconscious aspect, so crucial to Columbo's understanding of crime, gets displaced to problems the team members are having in their own lives. So suddenly, if there's a show about, you know, child abuse or whatever. Then you've in little scenes in CSI, you find out that the different women have been having problems with the custody of their child or whatever. It just goes around the block.
So in a way, it's more privatized. But it's so interesting. So why? Yeah, you know, why does this happen? Do you have a kind of theory about it?
Well, it's certainly a reformatting of the relationship to crime. I mean, Columbo is a late arrival of the master sleuth, the analyst who deals with crime one-on-one, more or less. So you have a group formatting of crime solution in CSI, which is accompanied, importantly, by a new trust in verifiable scientific data.
Right.
And I link that in my final chapter, for better or worse, to the establishment of DNA evidence. which, you know, began through the testing for paternity. So the first famous case of DNA testing used to identify a criminal was a case in which a father was also identified as the incestuous abuser of his daughter, in all in one movement. So for me, it's an important dislodgement of the father as the figure of abstraction, ambiguity, adoption, what have you. Because the one thing that is verifiable now is paternity. I think a side effect of DNA testing is even that maternity turns out to be less certain in terms of testing, which would explain the group, which would explain the group formatting, I think, because I think the group is always a syndication of the maternal bond. So that's a quick attempt at interpretation.
Well, yeah, and the other development, again, I don't know if this is something that was always there, but just it gets more highlighted, or I've just started to notice that the slasher splatter films, this genre, it seems to veer off, or I don't know if that's veering off is the right. It increasingly is employing these comedic kind of effects, not the CSI. You know, shows, but like, yeah, specifically this kind of horror film, this like splatter slasher films. So what is it? Did it always, what is the function? Like, how do these comedic effects actually function within these films? Or, and some of them are quite campy. And I don't know if it's just a sort of campus mode of reading. I'm reading it as campy, but it's not meant to be campy. I think it is, though. I think that there's a reflexivity.
Which films are you thinking about?
Oh, I don't know. You know, the films, I think it's more like the 80s, you know, even is Blair, would you consider Blair Witch is not comedic, but it's
no, but you know, I would say, the half-life of horror, tends to be comedy. Mm. So I'm already in the theater of Grand Guignol in Paris, where they, since the late 19th century, they had these, horror skits. They've just, went ahead with it and alternated horror skits with comedy skits because inevitably, because of the reliance on special effects in horror, as soon as that proves it all outdated, it becomes laughable. The Nightmare on Elm Street films very quickly became either laughable or tiresome, even though in real time people rushed to see those films for the special effects. So I think, again, anything that relies on the reality effect of a special effect, special reality effects, is going to lose the race against innovation and become outdated and laughable. Mm-hmm. So I know lots of vampire films that were camp, but I don't know a great many. I mean, there must be a few, but there must be very few horror films that were deliberately camp from the start. But they quickly fall back into that position, though.
I see. Yeah, I guess I was thinking about the Friday the 13th. You know, these, by the time you get to like whatever, the third or fourth, they just seem, but maybe that's just a mode of reading, or like you said, that they become dated, or they acquire that over time.
Yeah, I think they quickly get used up. They're quickly exhausted. I think when for the first viewing, you know, the group therapy that attended them took them very seriously. Mm. I mean, in one of the Friday the 13th films, I write about it in the book. Was it the fourth one? When the little boy is the protagonist whose hobby is making masks, and he, it looks anyway like he succeeds in killing Jason, apparently, according to something I read, a New York audience on the seeing the film for the first time got up and hugged and
oh god
and screamed with jubilation. I mean, but the price for that kind of real time synchronicity, as it were, is that it becomes dated and laughable very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, we're almost out of time, but I was wondering if you're working on anything now, or what the next, if there's a next project or a current project that you'd like to tell us about.
Well, that's always a problem with talking about a recently published book, is that I'm already in the next one.
Well, that's great. Tell us.
I've done everything I could not to talk about fantasy, but fantasy is my new project, both the genre, but also its reliance on wish fantasy or daydreaming, which I try to link to new digital mediation in an effort to answer the question why fantasy is the most popular genre and why it prevails whenever it is mixed into any other genre. I would say the mixing of B-genre, anyway, is the law right now, but fantasy always dominates. And I think that's because it has a certain proximity to the wish fantasy nature of the digital relation.
So
that's what I'm working on right now.
Oh, sounds great. Sounds really juicy. I can't wait. So you talk about fantasy with, a PH fantasy, or?
That's fantasy. The Kleinian view. Just to keep it simple, I'll probably keep it F fantasy. But yeah, I'm aware of the distinction.
Just wondering if you were going to go there. But
I will refer to the distinctions. But I mean, the genre calls itself fantasy with an F, so I might as well follow suit.
Mm-hmm.
Tolkien, came up with the name for the genre because he didn't want it to be for children only. That's why he tried to move away from the fairy story or fairy tale. But as a result, as you can read in his essay on the fairy story, he has to rush into a hyper-Christian reading of the fantasy genre to get away from the proximity to wish fantasy that he names with his naming of the genre.
Mm.
He says that the reason the fantasy genre is powerful, and the way it works, is that there is one fantasy that is true, namely the Christian redemption. Which, is wonderful, because the only fantasy I know that is true is the digital relationship,
right.
which is why fantasy is so so potent right now.
Oh, okay. Well, on that note, thanks. We should wrap up, but we've been talking to Larry Rickles about his brilliant new book, The Psycho Records. Larry, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me on it.
And thanks to our audience for listening. Till next time.